In this episode, I get to sit down and talk with Mr. Drew Hinton. We talk about all kinds of stuff coming out of the ASSP Safety 2021 conference. So it was sort of a mixed bag, but I'll let Drew drive the bus on this one and choose all the topics. So you could probably tell by the title of this podcast, we talk about all kinds of crazy stuff. We also recorded the video for this, and that is available for premium members of the Safety Pro Podcast community. Let's go right into my conversation with Drew Hinton. Before we get into today's topic, I want to remind everybody, if your business is reopening after any kind of closure due to COVID, or you've continued to remain open, but you're struggling with how to mark your facilities to ensure physical distancing and relay important information about safety and health as it relates to COVID, I want you to go visit our friends over at Mighty Line Floor Tape. Mighty Line has some great products for you to mark your floors, whether it be the stand here, the 6 feet distancing, or just floor tape to denote lanes of travel. They have everything you need to mark your facility. So hit the link in the show notes, visit our friends at Mighty Line Floor Tape. They are incredible partners in safety. I can't thank them enough for their support of the podcast. Again, Mighty Line Tape for all of your floor marking needs. Drew, what's happening, buddy?
Another day in somebody's paradise. How are you?
Not yours, but somebody's. Well, that's somebody. You're in, right now, you're in what, Louisiana?
No, I'm in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, Louisville. See, you're always all over the place. I can't keep up.
Texas 1 week and back to Kentucky and everywhere else in between.
Oh, yeah. So traveling. How's traveling now just with everything? Still pretty easy or, I mean?
Yeah, for the most part. I haven't seen any restrictions other than what's been going on, but I'm kind of curious to see, you know, what's coming up the next few months with all the cases spiking up and a lot of schools are, you know, starting to get more strict on their guidelines. So I'm curious how that'll go. But yeah, so far it's been fine.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, at the time that we're recording this, we're just starting hitting the end of summer, right? And in the Northeast, in the Midwest,
right?
You're going to see that cycle kick back in. It's seasonal somewhat. Yep. So, you know, in the South, you know, cases are going to go down. And then, of course, in the North and Northeast, Midwest, we're going to see it spike. So we're going to hit ours here soon. So one of those things, absolutely. Right? So what are we talking, dude? What are we talking about today? We should just catch up. We should.
Yeah, that's the name of the game. But no, we're going to kind of talk about kind of just the ASSP in review or the conference, and then the electrical standards or promotion in FPA, because I've seen a lot of variances recently on that and some misinterpretations, and it's kind of eye-opening on some things. I'll just say that.
Right, yeah. You know, we were texting back and forth when you were down at the conference. You know, I couldn't go this year, but and so I was asking you, like, hey, how are the breakout sessions and stuff? So yeah, give us a rundown on how it went with ASSP. What are they calling it nowadays? I get them all confused.
Yes, it's Safety 2021 is just what they call it this year.
Okay. Yeah,
so.
That's pretty, I should have remembered that one.
It keeps it simple. But no, it was good. Honestly, I think the biggest thing people were excited about was just getting out and getting into something to see people. Because I can't count how many people that I've chatted with and had conversations on LinkedIn or text or call, whatever it is, and never actually seen anybody. And so we got to actually meet up with people. But there were a lot of good sessions. You know, it took several on a variety of different topics. You know, one that really stood out to me, and it's kind of my focus, I guess, based on my PhD program I'm going through, is kind of the marijuana and the CBD aspect of it, how it incorporates the workplace. So they had Fisher Phillips there, three attorneys from Fisher Phillips, and doing several, talking about, you know, how to incorporate your policy, how to word that, the difference between, you know, just because you detect it doesn't mean they're impaired. So diving into your investigation of, and you know how you know it all changes from one year or one presidential administration to the next as far as the
right.
You know whether you do post incident testing, but they were kind of touching on that it does change, and if you're going to use it, just because it shows up doesn't necessarily mean that it's impairment and that it's a causal factor. And so it was
really good. I remember in Ohio. Do you remember this? Ohio BWC. Oh man, I'm going to show my age. So you probably don't remember this. You're younger than me. Taft was the governor. No, not that Taft. There was another Taft. Okay. And Taft was the, I'm not that old. Taft was the governor. And it used to be the employer had to show that a positive drug alcohol test was the proximate cause of a workplace injury. And this was all under Ohio BWC. So we're not talking about OSHA at this point. We're talking about workers' comp. Right. So it flipped to the burden then became, put on the worker. The worker had to show or prove that a positive drug or alcohol test result was not the proximate cause. We all loved that, right? We all thought, but to your point, what you're saying is, I remember they had established levels and they recognized that just because you test positive doesn't mean you're impaired. So they had, and I can't remember what organization they followed, the guidelines they followed, but it was certain levels of THC, for example. Right. And so it depended on what you detected and then what was the level at the time.
Right.
And then once it went past that threshold, that claim was automatically denied and the employee had to prove that they weren't impaired. I don't know how they would do that, but that's the way it was. So it's interesting you bring that up. What did you get a sense from any of their discussions of what levels they are, or does it vary? Or did they not get into the levels?
Yeah, and that's kind of what they were hitting on was it's going to vary because you know if I have 1,000 nanograms per milliliter of THC in my system versus you, everybody's going to react a little bit different. Everybody's, and especially when you're getting into like the whether you're inhaling it or you're ingesting it, whatever the method is, it's going to absorb at a different rate. It's going to metabolize at a different rate. And so that's kind of what the basis of what they were saying was there's no standard level. And somebody did ask that. They said, okay, with alcohol, there's a 0.08. That's your level. There's nothing really for that with marijuana. And that's kind of what we discussed is because it varies.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, it's going to be different for you and me. I mean, you have such a tolerance. I'm kidding. If anybody knows you, they would know how funny that is. But no, he does not. But yeah, no, but you're bringing up a good point because now they're putting it in food. And then the type, I mean, I don't want to get into this because I don't know. I'm going to show my ignorance here and just using the wrong words. They're different hybrids of plant.
Right.
And they have different concentration. So because it's all over the place, it's like makes it really hard for employers, does it not?
Yeah. Unless you're a DOT cover, their DOT is like, doesn't matter what it, I don't care what it is, where it's from. Any THC is a no-go. You're getting reported and you're going through all the return.
Well, the federal government.
Right. Federal standards.
Still has a zero tolerance for THC, but states have legalized it, and we're taught, and our discussions are how much should we allow versus instead of following the federal standard of going, what about liability? Did they talk about liability for a company that allows any of it?
Yeah, because they were even talking about some states, let's say hypothetically, like somebody in Colorado, an employer, they can still say, even though it's legalized in our state, recreational, medicinal. Right. They can still say it's our company policy to follow federal guidelines, even though it's just some random general store that has nothing to do with federal regs. And so they really put that in there, and because there's really not a way to accurately detect, it's a feasible method, I should say, to detect your impairment. They were going through workers' comp cases of, let's say the injury happened on the 14th, and today's the 17th, you send somebody for a test, well, the workers' comp was, even though it showed positive, they would throw that case, they would deny that claim because And it's 3 days after the incident. I don't know whether or not it occurred at the incident time or within the 3 days since then.
Right.
You know, that I brought up, I talked with Barry Spurlock from EKU. He was one of the presenters, and I talked with him afterwards. I said, you know, a lot of the policies that I see, you know, I use forklifts, for example. You know, forklift policies would say, you know, an operator is not to operate a powered industrial truck under the influence or impaired. Well, you know, that's a subjective term, right? Because that's what we're talking about, is it varies. So how can you enforce that if there's no really black and white? And I know with OSHA there's a lot of gray areas, but how do you enforce not to operate impaired? You know, and that's what I talked about. So you specify, you know, are you going 0 THC if you're a true drug-free workplace? Is it 0.0% THC at all? Or, you know, what that level is?
Yeah. Hey, you just reminded me of something. Hypothetically, and I'm going to say this a little tongue-in-cheek. I'm going to be a little silly about it, but seriously, if it's legal, and let's say before I come to work, I eat one of them fun brownies. I don't know. Maybe is that considered self-medicating then if I come to work and it is a proximate cause? Like I am a little, I'm under the influence by definition, and I walk into the wall, something stupid like that.
Right, right.
And I chip my tooth. Now, from a record keeping standpoint, is that a result of self-medicating? I mean, where, right? I mean, where do we draw that line?
Yeah, and that's, you know, kind of, we're talking about a little bit, of course, only an hour session there. And so that gets into what the purpose of it is. You know, I think, and you and I talked about, you know, text, phone call previously, you know, am I truly using it for medicinal purposes? Am I using it recreationally just because I want to, right? And so is it really a self-medication, or am I, more or less, am I actually under the influence because I took a recreational drug prior to work? And so that kind of gets into your incident investigation, where you're really going to have to determine what that is. And that's, there's a lot of hoops that you got to jump through, and things that you can't ask and things that you can't ask. So
there was a high school student, my son came home and told me this. The ambulance had to come pick him up. Apparently he tried to vape in the bathroom. He was vaping. I don't know if it was too much or he hadn't done it before, but he passed out. He fell on the floor. And so I'm thinking, like, okay, I'm trying to say, let's say this is a young adult, but in the workplace, and that happened and he fell down and hit his head, you know, self-medicating. I mean, it's not work related, but you know, it happened in the work environment. So, I mean, people think it's just cut and dry, right? That this is like settled in society, the CBD and marijuana. There are a lot of things that employers have to consider. And when we legislate, we legalize this stuff. And this is not a discussion about whether it should be legal or shouldn't be legal. That's for another episode. Right. But you cannot ignore the implications when it is legalized and the societal, you know, how society comes into the workplace. Right. And the actual employer is left with trying to sort this out.
Right. And
it's crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, so like Kentucky, I'm not sure about Ohio, but like Kentucky, CBD is legalized. And that's kind of what they were explaining. Like Kristen from Fisher Phillips, she was from Denver, Colorado. And she explained that, you know, I'm going to say majority, it may have been all, but I'm going to say majority just to be, you know, accurate here. But she said the majority of states that have legalized, whether it's medicinal or recreational, have all started with CBD. So you know that's what's coming, right? So,
yeah. So, those dominoes, right?
So we know that marijuana at some point is probably going to be coming to Kentucky because we've already legalized CBD. And so, you know, employers.
You know, and CBD, that's an unregulated industry. It's like the supplement industry, right? Or vitamin industry.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you could have CBD oil from the same manufacturer, one little bottle of it 1 week to the next week could have a wide swing in concentration of whatever they found, heavy metals in these things. So, I mean, if we're going to legalize it in that regard, I mean, there should be some standards like we have with food and other drugs. But yeah, it's considered a supplement. And I mean, manufacturers can put whatever in there.
Yeah, and that's something that I've, you know, of course, I'm doing my doctorate doctoral research on that, but you know, Epidiolex is the only CBD drug, like actual medication approved by the FDA for seizure medications, a few other issues. And so they've got some kind of guidelines just for that. And so you would think they'd kind of branch that over to,
you know, and it may get there, right. which might, this might force the issue, which I guess is a good outcome. You at least have a standard.
Right.
And then that might make it easy because it's regulated and they're all made to the same standard and concentration, same type or whatever. Then it might be easier to, you know, kind of, you know, when you look at detection and levels, if it's based on that established standard, manufacturing standard and concentration levels and or lack thereof in CBD oil, for example. Yeah, that might be what we need. We might need to force that whole just regulating it. Yeah.
So, well, I mean, and then even if it's not regulated, for most, I'm going to say reputable distributors, if you order some online, or if it's a cream or salve or whatever it is, they're going to send you a COA with it, but you're not going to get that when you go to the gas station down the street and get one off the counter. You're not going to get that COA.
Man, gas stations are sketch. They're sketchy.
I don't think they know where
they're hate gas stations. You know, people think I'm just a big greenie and that's why I want an electric vehicle. Like, you know, I'm looking at these Teslas and stuff. And yeah, I get that. But mostly it's so I don't have to go to another dang gas station ever again. Those places are terrible. And so you remember walking in, they used to sell those little pills. They were called White Cross.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
See, now I know you're old. So... Do they still sell? I try not to go inside any gas station, but do they still sell that crap?
I don't know. They've got a rack full of miscellaneous.
We don't know what it is they're selling out of there. Oh my gosh. So yeah, there you go. Good old gas station supplies. So that was one topic. What was another, a topic that you really zoned in on and, had some good takeaways?
So one was kind of like the other topic we're going to discuss is like the electrical safety. So there was a guy there that taught a class on the NFPA 7E standard, but he focused specifically on the human performance aspect of it, which isn't really outlined.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of OSHA standards, the NFPA 7E specifically does mention that. They have a whole annex talking just about human performance. And so we really honed in on that. I thought it was really informative. Even as many classes I've taken, it's still a great refresher, and I always learn something from a different instructor every time. But he really looked at some of the error precursors, how we're identifying those error precursors, and then how we're going to help mitigate those. You know, the way that it's worded in like the NFPA 7E, the annex for the human performance, it flat out says people are fallible, and even the best people make mistakes. Like, it just comes out and says that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think. Historically, at least what my experience from consulting and private industry and all these other different industries is that people use the human error aspect improperly. They'll either blanket it across the board and say, well, such and such should have known better. It's their fault. We're going to blame it on human error. But they're not really taking into the, you know, prevention through design aspect of it. They're not taking into the investigation aspect of it. Okay, why did this human error occur? You know, if I'm up working EMS and I injected 2 milligrams of a drug when it should have been 0.2, okay, that's human error, but maybe the scale was on the syringe is extremely difficult to read. Yeah. Bouncing up and down the back of the ambulance, it's one completely different thing. And so
it was an emergent case. They were operating under stress. How much sleep did they get when they last went to sleep? I mean, we know so much about human error now, and I don't know why in the workplace we haven't caught up with that.
Right. And I think it was one of your podcasts that I started tagging on. I think, I don't know where you said that came from, maybe the military, about the fatigue management as far as, so I've taken that and ran with it. Everywhere I've worked at, you know, as a consultant or a private industry, my incident investigation forms look at how many hours of sleep you've had, how many days you worked in the last 14 days.
Yep. How many hours? Well, a lot of places you run into this too. A lot of places they do like mandatory overtime, right? Yep. And do these companies limit the number of times they can issue mandatory overtime to an individual in a row before they have to, you know, say, we have to skip this worker because they've already worked two shifts in concurrent shifts on mandatory overtime. We need to give them a break. I mean, that's called learning from this stuff.
Right.
And so, yeah, good point. So human error, it's like I actually saw it was an electrical related incident where an individual was standing in front of a panel and they called it out as human error. This was several years ago. And they showed me the photo of the video. And it was an electrical maintenance worker and opened a panel. And they were like, yeah, they know they're trained. You stand to the side. There was a bollard right there. They could not stand to the side. And the way the door opened, they were right there and they did something. An event occurred. It was a minor issue. They weren't injured, thank goodness, but they wrote it up as human error. And I'm like, really? Because that sounds like an error trap, right? That yes, I'm supposed to stand to the side. Right. However, something occurred in this case that required them to alter what we would expect them to do. And if you don't look for that, you miss making improvements altogether and just blame the worker.
Yeah, we say they deviated from the SOPs, but we forced them to deviate from that SOP by not.
But why?
Not planning for it.
But why? Yeah, even if it's because they say it was at the end of shift. I'm trying to hurry. I have to. And it's like, well, what creates that sense of urgency, and can we influence that? And you still can't let yourself off the hook as an organization, right?
Right.
And that's what's great about that whole topic. Is once you get your mind wrapped around this concept that people are fallible, right? They do make mistakes. And that as an organization, our job is to determine, you know, how can we make one, our processes more resilient to mistakes we could expect people to make, one. But two, how can we influence the environment, the work process, the work structure? And man, I was just talking to Jonathan, another community member, Safety Pro community member, yesterday about this. And that is, you know, we say safety is a priority and we don't want anyone to get hurt. And then we go right into our meetings about like, hey, how come you only closed two work orders in the last hour? You know, we need three. Why? What, you know, or how many we're behind on our PMs? Why? And it's like that pressure.
Yeah.
And we don't make that connection that can lead to even subconsciously like skipping a step or rushing and trying to catch up because we're trying to meet a metric, another metric that they're tracking to,
right?
Which is not safety.
Yeah.
So
I've seen that more so in the manufacturing setting, of course, because you're trying to get stuff out the door. And I was actually having a conversation with a customer yesterday about this. You know, there was a company that I worked directly for prior to consulting that they had several large TVs up on the wall near their production lines. And each hour, each line had its own separate TV. And every hour it either have a red sad face or a green smiley face to let you know whether you hit that quota. And they're like, oh, we're not brushing you, but indirectly you are. They see a red sad face, they're going to actually want a green happy face.
Yeah.
And even
that's you reminded me when we went to Cedar Point. I think I posted this earlier in the summer in the community on the community site. The workers literally run up and down the amusement the roller coaster, the cars, right, and do the check real quick and it to get people out. Their goal is to keep the line moving. That's their goal.
Right.
And so this guy is rushing us to get on this ride. The Whitewater Rapids ride, yeah. You know, the big round thing where like 10 people can fit on. And he's saying, hurry, 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 but be careful. And then I looked at him and I go, which one do you want? And he kind of laughed. And I'm like, cause you can't have both. It's a wet wooden surface deck. People aren't wearing the appropriate shoes. We're talking about the general public. Some are flip flops. Some don't have, some took off their shoes because they're going to get wet. And you're going, go, hurry, go, 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 because this ride's going to come out. They don't want to stop that carousel, right, to let somebody get in properly. Yeah. It's, you just reminded me the smiley face and the happy face. We're not telling you to rush, but hurry up.
Yeah. Why do you have a row full of red sad faces?
Yeah. There you go.
He's talking about kind of that rotation schedule and like the overload. It made me think of the last fire department I worked at in Louisville. their overtime call list, they just went straight down a list. So there was no skipping around or picking favorites or, you know, whatever it is. You go straight down a list, and, you know, so that way you know you're not getting overloaded. Now, sure, if everybody before you says, no, I can't do it, and it gets to you, then, yeah, there's a chance you can do that. But it did reduce that and kind of kept a systematic way of making sure that everybody's getting an offer, you know, from the, you know, let's get overtime, gets money portion of it, but also keeping it spread out to where we're not overloading that same person over and over.
Man. Hey, I worked for a client years ago. They had rotating shifts. I mean, it was terrible. So like every month when I went back, it was cool for me because I would see a whole different crew during the day, right? The problem was there was a 2 week changeover. So I'm going to work first shift for 2 weeks. Then I'm going to second shift for 2 weeks. Then I'm going to third shift for 2 weeks. Then I'm back on first shift for 2 weeks. Everybody was constantly in a fog, like your circadian rhythm, you know, what we know about sleep wake cycles and the amount of time your body needs to adjust to a shift change. I mean, it could be 7 to 10 days. Yeah. And then by the time you finally get those last 3 days where you're firing on all cylinders, you switch to another shift. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. And I said, well, why do you do this? What drives this? Well, it was,
I get an extra $3 an hour.
Well, I think it was like, it was part of their CBA because they were unionized. Right. And it was like, everybody gets the chance at first. And I'm like, what? Yeah, it was nuts. I couldn't believe it. So human factors being a focus in the electrical safety standard, that's pretty cool. Yeah. That's pretty cool. What else? Any other takeaways?
So they had Jim Fredericks from OSHA come in, and supposed to be there, but he had a pre-recorded message, but he did come on at the end for like a more or less live talk with us at the end to kind of give us an overview. They did talk about some of the, you know, the budget request. They're requesting X amount of $1 million. They are requesting this money more, you know, full-time employees to help out, because we know their primary way of enforcement is not inspections, and that it can't be because there's not enough people to be inspecting every facility. And so, but it is good that they're requesting that, because, you know, I think I've talked with you, you know, text or call before about, like here in Kentucky, we've had a few cases where OSHA's sending people fresh out of college with 2 or 3 years experience.
Yeah.
No real experience, but they're getting sent to do, you know, consultative audits on their own. You know, it's one thing if you send somebody to shadow, but they're getting sent out and they're like, hey, I just graduated in 2019. I'm like, and you're here representing OSHA?
Well, what you're talking about, though, is unique. And that's what we should make a distinction for the listeners. When you say consultation, you're referring to like the OSHA on-site consultation.
Right. Yeah. So you can, you know, they got several customers that will voluntarily invite OSHA's consultative side in to do an audit. They come out here and did a health audit 1 week, and then a couple weeks later, they did a safety audit. And so it's completely separate from, you know, the enforcement side. And it does give you we still got a good report from it. It'll tell you the findings, and they still tell you a time frame on abatement. As long as you fix it within a time frame, they don't turn it over to the enforcement side. So you get 30 days typically on most issues. And so it's definitely a good resource. I know every state calls a little bit different.
Well, yeah, it's a good resource, but good, it being a good resource is dependent on what?
Who they're sending.
the value that the individual is bringing to the site, right, and their insight and their experience. And no, they don't need to be the 50 year veteran, and she or he brings all that experience. But certainly we're not talking about somebody who just got hired and just graduated and hasn't worked anywhere.
Right.
It's not that they're not valued. It's just, it is what it is, right? Experience is experience.
Yep.
And yeah, there's bad experience. You could have somebody who's been doing something for 35 years, but they've been doing it poorly for 35 years. And so the number of years doesn't mean you're good. But what we're talking about is the quality of the individual really drives the benefit you get out of the OSHA on-site.
Right.
And you shared with me we won't say where or you know who, but some write-ups that were like just incorrect.
Yeah.
They were just wrong.
Right.
If you recall that.
Yep.
And so, you know, I don't see that as a very good service if the customer getting the service is correcting the service provider. And it's like, well, if I already knew that, then we didn't need you.
Right.
But interesting. So yeah, this hiring, I mean, they've got to compete with we're talking about a federal agency, and let's face it, dollar for dollar has a hard time competing with the private sector.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Pay and benefits, right. Time off, that kind of stuff. So, wow, I'd be interested to see like how that goes, where they're getting all these folks from, you know?
Right. And I was kind of talking with a former coworker, and he actually used to be a CSHO for Kentucky and Indiana OSHA. And that's kind of the way he explained it. He said, if either you're new and you're gaining your experience, or if you know what you're doing and you're good, then you're a supervisor and you're not out there.
You're out of the field.
You're right. There's no in between.
It's sort of like, some fire departments.
Yep. Exactly.
But all kidding aside, that seems to be how it works, right? We take the folks that are really, really good at it and we're like, oh, wow, you can manage other people to get to this point. And then you go right back down to a knowledge gap, and which is crazy.
Right.
So that was at the end. So all in all, I mean, I saw you posted a picture. Hopefully I'll be able to throw that photo up here. I think you sent it to me on the screen here as I'm talking about it. You mentioned it earlier. It was just nice to get to see people.
Yeah.
And so that was a good time. You went out and met with a bunch of folks. What did you go to, like the local restaurant, or where was that photo?
So there was 6th Street in Austin, downtown Austin. I don't know. I guess people are familiar with Louisville, like Louisville, it's equivalent, I guess, of Louisville's 4th Street Live. It's kind of just where all the, you know, the sports bars and restaurants and kind of just that's the place to go, more or less. And so we went to several different places, and yeah, we saw Mr. Howard Light himself there. So that was definitely a great time. And like I said, I was sitting in line at a barbecue truck one day on lunch break, and they had a barbecue truck outside of the conference center. And just two people looked at my name tag and said, Hey, we're connected on LinkedIn. Like, and so we just,
isn't that great?
Worked up a conversation. It's like, you know, like I said, that's honestly, that was probably the best part, is just getting to meet people and talking about their operations and what they're getting out of this conference and, you know, how just everything. It was great.
Yeah. That's incredible. So, what do you see change? Like, okay, so you sat in on the electrical standards one, and it focused on human performance. So let's take that to the workplace in practical terms. In your experience more recently, how well informed are companies on, like, forget OSHA, because I mean everyone defaults to OSHA.
Right.
But and you're real big on this. This is why I love reading your posts and talking to you, because you're like, you know, there are other things out there besides an OSHA regulation that apply to you,
yep,
whether you know it or not. Right. So what are we talking about there?
Yeah. And so, I mean, whether it's NFPA or ANSI standard or ASTM, whatever it is, you know, a lot of people aren't familiar with those because, one, they may not know how to access them. But with NFPA, you can create an online account on their website and access every standard online for free. You can't print it off, but you can still view the whole entire thing online for free. That, you know, that's one deterrent from people is, well, I've got to go buy this standard, you know, especially for NFPA 70E, I got to go buy this standard. It's going to be updated in 3 years again. And so that may deter it, but, you know, the OSHA side doesn't, as most people should know, OSHA doesn't tell you how to go about these things. And so he was actually having some good conversations after some of those sessions about, you know, competencies. How are we evaluating competencies? So one of the conversations I had with one of the gentlemen presenting was, or he brought up, how are you evaluating competency in, you know, gas testing, atmospheric monitoring? Because there's nothing in OSHA that says, here's what a person doing using a gas meter is going to have to do. But when you go to NFPA 350, like the combined space standard, it tells you here's competencies, here's knowledge competencies they should be able to know, here's physical things they should be able to do. And that, you know, getting back over to the NFPA 70E, like the electrical side, there are, you know, they incorporate, like we're talking about human performance, they incorporate a whole different hiring controls than what most people use from NIOSH. They add in that extra aspect of the awareness level. So they put that in between engineering and administrative controls. So they add that sixth level to the hierarchy. So it's a little bit different. And, you know, yeah, we should be making sure people are aware of the hazard recognition, but how much are we actually doing that?
Man, you're hitting on something that is so important. The I'm going to call it the vagary of OSHA. There's the, you know, you got a vertical standard. It's very specific. It's prescriptive. But then the flip side to OSHA, as we know, is sometimes they don't give, they just say, it's up to the employer to ensure that operators are qualified. And then you're like, well, what does that mean? What is that? Well, we have other best practices or other we'll call them standards because they're not technically enforceable, like ANSI. Right. They're incorporated by reference by OSHA. Otherwise, we look at those as benchmarks in the industry.
Right.
There's operator training certifications that, well, okay, we're going to send you off to operator training on this specific type of equipment. We're going to use that curriculum and that certification to show to OSHA.
Right.
Yes, we ensure that our equipment operators are competent. Here's how.
Yep.
They miss that here's how part. Yep. And so it's really important what you said. Anybody listening, especially with the confined space, like somebody who's able to operate these meters, there is something you can follow to give you some guidelines as to whether or not Blaine should be monitoring this space with this equipment. And you mentioned the NFPA, right?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting because, like, specifically with the NFPA 70E, it's not incorporated by reference. There are NFPA standards that are incorporated by reference, but that one's not. You know, some people are under the pressure that, OSHA incorporates by reference. No, they don't. Now, the caveat to where they can potentially get you under, you know, of course, the general duty clause is if it's a recognized hazard, whether that's by the employer or by the industry. So NFPA 70E puts it on the forefront. And they're going to look at, could following that national consensus, voluntary consensus standard, whatever you want to call it, could following that have reduced a significant risk in your workplace?
Bingo. Yeah, good stuff, man. Good stuff. So what's next for you? What are you into now on the horizon? More conferences? What are you doing?
We're working on submitting a couple proposals for next year's conference. It's actually coming up pretty quick. I guess COVID pushed this one back this year, but next one's is in June, end of June. And so working on a couple proposals for that one. We're actually going to be working with Draeger on that one. And we're going to submit two, one for confined space and one for air monitoring. And that's
nice.
And that's really what, you know, how come fire department, you can relate as well. I've seen many employers say, well, NFPA is just for firefighters. No, not necessarily the case.
If you work in a building in this country, NFPA applies to you, whether you realize it or not.
Right.
I mean, if you look at it, the sprinkler system, fire extinguishers, I mean, the signs, just something as basic as that.
Right. And that's kind of what we're going to go on is because, like you said, I'm huge on the national consensus standards, whether it's an NFPA or ANSI or whatever it is diving into those. You know, how should I be evaluating, you know, NFPA refers to it as a gas tester. How should I be evaluating my competency of my gas testers? I'm not just handing you a 4S meter and say, here, go turn this on, drop the tube in there and you're good. You know, how do I know that they can interpret those, even though it's just showing me four gases, maybe five, six, whatever it is, it'll read everything. It just shows you four, five, or six. You got to figure out how to read between the lines. And so that's what we're gonna go with and run with.
Oh, come on. All you got to do is show them how to zero it out outside. That's all.
Stand next to the exhaust on the fire truck too.
Right next to the exhaust by the generator. How to zero out the meter?
That's your bump test.
the bump. I'm not kidding. Somebody thought a bump test was you have to drop the meter and see if it still works.
Hey,
that was a competent person.
Right. Honestly, some of these things, I've had conversations on LinkedIn and other platforms as well about like people say, what's common sense? I've had, a former employer, the general manager is like trying to say, his words were like, I should have a PhD in, common sense or human error evaluation, I forget how you worded it, but he was trying to say he understood it and everything was common sense. That was the first thing out of his mouth when something happened. Well, what did such and such do? And, I always refer back to, I think it was Psychology Today, they had an article about that, more or less kind of summed it up, is it's not common sense unless you've been there, done that.
There is no sense common amongst most people.
Right.
There isn't.
Right.
I had somebody at the DOD explain this to a group of us once. We were between sessions, training sessions. We were all just sitting around having a discussion, and he summed it up like I think perfectly. He said, "You know what common sense is? Common sense is when a 2-year-old walks up and sticks their finger in a light socket or an electrical socket. That is the sense common among a lot of 2-year-olds."
Yep.
He says, and then they start to learn. You tell them, you teach them that that's bad because you learned it. You were there and you either did that or they was told to you.
Right.
So you help them develop. And then when they become adolescents, common sense is, the sense common amongst most teenagers is try to stay out late at night and try to ask a girl to the movies or whatever. There's sense common. But then when you get out of high school, and then everybody kind of goes their different ways. Some people go into skilled trades. Some people go into the military. Some people go to college. He goes, that just blows common sense out. We don't have, as adults, sense that is common amongst most adults. Like you could look at most 2-year-olds would stick their finger in an electrical socket.
Right.
Adults, we don't have a sense common amongst us. Even among certain adult groups, like this, electricians. How many times have you seen an electrician work on stuff live?
Right. Whether they're supposed to or not.
Yeah. So to me, common sense says, and the regulations, that if you have to lock that out, isolate that energy, control that energy, or follow a live electrical permit, if it meets the qualification for leaving it on, which many of them don't and people think they do. And then even then, you still have to have the level of PPE to the level as if it were not live.
Right.
And but so even among like plumbers and electricians and carpenters, we see variation in how they approach work. So an adult person saying common sense, I just cringe.
Right.
Absolutely cringe.
It's funny. No, it's funny, but you brought that up about energized electrical work. I had a customer that they had somebody get shocked by 277 working on a live. They were putting in a switch, but got shocked by 277 volts. And, I always preface my, when I'm doing an investigation, I always preface, well, look, I'm not trying to put you in the corner or point fingers. My job is to figure out what happened, figure out how we can improve, and how we can fix it moving forward. That's the whole goal of my investigation, is not to, write up your whole separate thing if it warrants it. They don't always warrant that. But I one of the things I said, this company, I said, you do have a energized electrical work permit, which wasn't filled out. And so I said, had you looked through that, it has the 4 justifications from NFPA 7E on when you can work on live electrical circuits. And your reasoning for working on live is not one of these 4. So I could say, I could just get a cop-out answer of, well, that should have been common sense. You should have known that. But that's what the company is doing to account for that human error. We're gonna have a permit that's going to list out so they don't have to think of, what were those 4 reasons Drew taught in our arc flash class a few months ago that I can work on live? Oh, here it is. Oh, I don't meet these 4 criteria. No, can't do it. Simple as that.
Shut it down. Schedule it for another time. I mean, that's logistics 101.
Yeah.
It's most of the time people just want to do it when it's convenient. And they don't want to interrupt, you know, some production order they got going. Right. It's like, well, schedule it for third shift, schedule it for another time, schedule it ahead of time, you know, but nobody wants to do that. Right. It's that we got to go and we got to go do it now type of thing. And it's only going to take me a minute, you know, that kind
customer
of stuff.
Ask, we say yes.
There you go. Yeah, that's a consultant in you talking.
That's right. About
awesome. So, hey, look, I'm glad we were able to catch up.
Absolutely.
Talk about a few things. This is like a round robin. I don't even know how I'm going to title this episode.
We'll just call it round robin.
No, I'm going to call it marijuana and electricity.
Perfect. Perfect.
It'll get people to click on it.
What is this?
Yeah, clickbait. All right, marijuana, electricity. So we'll have to catch up again soon. We're always talking on the community site as well. Do you know, I think I've said this before, you are the very first community member. Very first ever.
I need a certificate and a plaque. It's going on the wall.
Do you need a plaque? Yeah, I'll send you a plaque. What do I have laying around here?
I need a prop.
I don't know. I'll find something to send you.
Behind you.
Oh, they gave me that when I left. When I left a large facility in Monroe, Ohio. They were nicknamed the Pilots. So
oh, nice.
When I left, they gave me that, and then they changed the locks. So, all right, man. Well. Keep on keeping on. It was good to catch up, and I can't believe I caught you in your home state of Kentucky. You're always on the go.
It's good, but it's been great catching up.
Yeah, it's good. So I love hearing your stories. A combination of taking me back to the day, you know, when I was a road warrior and running around doing all this stuff. But you know, I'm glad we got folks like you out there. Not all consultants are built the same. So I appreciate you out there providing that valuable service to a lot of these organizations that quite frankly right now are hurting for keeping their people safe and protecting their people. So thank you for being out there and doing what you do, man.
Absolutely appreciate that.
All right. We'll talk soon. All right.
All right. Take care.
All right. There you have it. A mashup of topics that Drew wanted to talk about from the ASSP Safety 2021. Look, I can't encourage you all enough. Go ahead and check out the Safety Pro Podcast community site. You know, we have conversations like this going on all the time. Think about becoming a member and join in our conversations over there. And I will talk to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast.